From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
If I say garden maintenance, you probably think of work, of getting out the pruners and hedge trimmers and such, and subduing any over-enthusiastic plants, getting them back into bounds. But what if we thought of maintenance as an expression of creativity instead of merely restraint, as part of the art of garden making? What if we figured it into our design decisions right from the start? Particularly as our gardens shift in a more ecological direction and become more naturalistic, that adjustment and approach seems especially important. Ongoing creative maintenance is our topic today with Noel Kingsbury and Annie Guilfoyle, hosts of the popular Garden Masterclass series of workshops and webinars. So more in a moment, but first, this message.
Underwriting support from Color Blends, supplying top quality spring blooming Dutch flower bulbs to landscape professionals and ambitious home gardeners. More information on the web, colorblends.com.
Annie Guilfoyle is an award-winning garden designer and longtime teacher of design. Noel Kingsbury, with an astonishing 25 books to his credit, is a noted garden writer, teacher, and consultant. Together, they've created gardenmasterclass.org, hosting both in-person workshops in the UK and online horticultural webinars for gardeners worldwide. Welcome to both of you. It's so great to connect this way.
Well, thank you for having us.
Yes, it's really lovely to be here.
Yes. I was so glad when we corresponded recently, the three of us, and you two suggested that we talk about rethinking maintenance as part of sort of the design and evolution of a garden, because I've long bristled at plants that on their labels boast claims of low maintenance and the idea of no work gardens and all this kind of nonsense. So and now I hear you giggling.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, in the US for certain, those have long been among the dominant selling points. And I don't know, a garden lives and breathes, doesn't it? So set the tone for us.
Right. Well, I think the whole drive to low maintenance is essentially, it's just like a sort of lowest common denominator. It's almost in denial that a lot of people enjoy gardening, and actually it's the maintenance that they enjoy doing. It's an appeal not just to the lazy, but almost to an anti-gardening aesthetic. I think that's why I get so annoyed about the no maintenance or low maintenance label.
I think also, yes. Noel, it's driven by a fear of not knowing. It's going, yes, into the unknown. So I think, yeah, often when people say low maintenance, it's because they're scared of the techniques or the work, that not only the volume of work, but also just, you know, I don't know if I'm going to be able to look after this. You're going to create a monster. How am I going to care for it? And I think fear, you know, this irrational fear is drives people as well.
Yeah. Annie, you said in an email the other day something about, as a designer, one of the first questions you ask prospective clients is, yeah, who's going to maintain this and how?
Absolutely. That's my very first question. It has to be the first question, because, you know, you need to establish from the start, you know, what is the bandwidth? what is the scope of the garden? What's the scope of the works, and who is going to be maintaining it? You know, the sort of clients that I have do not have teams of gardeners. Very often it's them looking after it, or they need to get some help with it. And so, right, you know, you've just got to, that's the first thing. And then, you know, and then that box has to be ticked, and then you move on to the next one. Yeah.
So Noel, you've been such a leader in communicating and participating in the sort of naturalistic garden movement. It has so many different names depending on who you ask, but you know what I mean. And yeah, so yeah, with this, and now it's finally reached a mass understanding, or at least people are really adopting it at all levels. And so how does this figure in there then? It's especially important, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, in traditional gardening, it's very much about keeping everything more or less the same. And so traditionally, maintenance has been quite a kind of seen quite negatively and quite low skill. But as we move from horticulture through to what I would call horticultural ecology, or indeed ecological horticulture, plants are closer together, they're at higher density, there's self-seeding going on, there's natural processes, plants are interacting. And we know a lot about how to grow plants well. We know much less about what happens when ecology takes over from horticulture, and we start to have this interaction. And I think, you know, personally, I find that interaction absolutely fascinating. But it does mean that the role of whoever is doing the maintenance is moving from keeping it the same to having to predict more about what will happen. So it's more about managing, editing, fine-tuning, nuancing. We're looking at a whole range of other verbs, in fact, to describe the process. And a lot of them are actually about creative. It's about seeing a planting as something that is alive, has its own dynamic, perhaps its own agenda. And there's that sense that the unpredictability adds to the little bit of danger, perhaps, but to the hugely, I think, to the interest.
Yeah, I mean, I will confess, and I totally understand why people want to sort of subdue their gardens and get them back to the way. Why won't it just behave and stay in bounds? You know, that kind of thing. Because I mean, I've been in the same place maybe 35 years, and so it doesn't look the same as it used to, you know, needless to say. And sometimes I look at old pictures and I think, oh, I liked that shape when that was that way. But it's alive, right?
Yeah.
And I think following on from what Noel was saying about, you know, about the word maintenance, you know, this autumn I went to the Beth Chatto Symposium, and it was mooted there that we shouldn't be using the term maintenance, because that is implying that something is staying the same. And as Noel has just explained, you know, nothing stays the same. You know, things move and change and die or grow or whatever. And so that very word maintenance perhaps is giving people an impression that it's like a interior, that wherever you put the furniture, it will stay there. Well, of course it won't, you know.
Yeah. So what are we, if we want to think about this as part of our creative process, the maintenance plan, and for those of us who aren't starting fresh, designing a new garden, I mean, how do you help people in your teaching and you know, with clients, et cetera, how do you help them to sort of see this differently? What are some of the maintenance tasks that you help evolve for them, you know, develop into this new world way of thinking of them?
Well, I do a workshop, which I've done many times over the last 10 years, which I call rather whimsically the rabbit's eye view, because it's about getting down on hands and knees and looking at what is going on at the base of the plant. And that for me is fundamental. It's about understanding the plant and understanding what the plant is capable of doing, or indeed not capable of doing. And once you've got that sort of begin to develop, and it's quite an intuitive feeling about plants, you're then in a much better position to be able to predict and plan those maintenance tasks, but particularly about things like understanding fairly soon if something's going to be self-seeding, if it's going to be rapidly spreading, if it's going to stay in one place, those kind of things.
Yes.
Following on from that, sorry to butt in, is that I think it's also about teaching people to stop and look and observe before you decide which route to take. And I've noticed this. I teach at Great Dixter, and I've noticed that the students, some of the students there, when we're talking about propagation, they just want to be told, how do you do it? How do you do it? Well, you know, it's encouraging people to look at a plant, just as Noel was saying, try and read what the plant's telling you, because if there's nobody standing behind you always saying this is where you cut it, you know, you're learning to look at the signs of where do you prune or where do you cut something back or how do you propagate. And I think we in general have lost that willingness to stand and observe and just take some time to sort of study, rather than I need to know where's the app, someone can tell me, you know.
Right. And the pruning is a great example, because as a garden writer for many years, probably the most frequently asked question that I get is, when do I prune my fill in the blank? And usually it's a hydrangea. It's a species of hydrangea, you know. And so I sometimes, you know, if I'm in an irritable mood or something, I'm feeling short-tempered, ill-tempered or whatever, I want to say, go out and look at the stems and see what it wants to tell you. To see how the plant grows. When does it bloom on New World wood, and what does that inform for you? You know, how does that inform you? What can you infer from that? I mean, so let's talk a little bit more about that. About, like, with pruning, if we're talking about maintenance, we have to understand the way a plant grows, right, in order to prune it. Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it is, I think people are nervous generally about gardening. They think it's a sort of magical, well, it is magical. We know it's magical, but they think there's this some sort of dark power, you know, and they're not party to this information. I think it's about unlocking, like you just said, Margaret, about teaching, saying, look at the stems. Where is the new growth? Where is the old growth? And suddenly if you just have to unlock those little methods, and people lose the fear of, and of course, it's like, what's the worst that could happen? You're going to cut it incorrectly. You probably won't kill it. It's going to look unhappy. You know, you've got to take away that. It's taking away that fear and just giving people confidence. And I mean, all teaching is about confidence giving. At the end of the day, it's about communicating and giving people confidence to go and do what you're, what they want to do in their gardens.
Yeah. I mean, Noel, you brought up sort of what I think of as like editing, where you have, say, self-sowers, things that are inclined to volunteer or spread or whatever, and that we need to learn to edit. So can we talk a little bit more maybe about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that has to be very much learnt in your garden place, particularly with self-sowing, which is extremely difficult to predict. Some things will self-sow like crazy, and then, you know, halfway down the road, somebody will never have seeding. And there's a sort of cycle you go through when something first, seedlings of something that you've planted, begin to appear. There's always that thrill, oh, it must be happy here. And the ideal point is, you know, you get a certain number of them coming up. There are those occasions, though, when things just begin to come up absolutely everywhere and you realize, yes, this is going to become a bit of a weed, or something that kind of gets to a particular point. Actually, there's a euphorbia I used to grow that was a, you know, really lovely plant, but it would get to a particular point and then always fall over. And you know, that had to go. So it's very much about observing. I mean, I really stress that this observing what is going on in your garden, particularly when you are down hands on knees weeding and looking and just seeing what is actually seeding and how far and in what kind of places. That's always a good place to start.
And encouraging people to make notes, you know, to get a little garden notebook and keep notes through the season so that they can start to gain confidence in and overseeing their own garden rather than, you know, feeling trepidatious about it.
And it can even be, you know, if they don't keep up with the notes, everybody is so addicted to their cell phones, we can take a before picture of there's this thing that just, like you said, the euphorbia that flopped over, whatever. And then what you did next, do you know what I mean? And those are all dated in our electronic library of photos, you know? So it's kind of like we can remind ourselves also visually if need be, I think. I like to write things down, but you know,
And I think there's a sort of trope of conventional gardening that a plant that is strongly spreading is people are quite nervous of them. And there's a sort of feeling, oh, if it's sending out runners, for example, it's kind of set on world domination, or if not world domination, at least domination of your border. But so often these plants they're not so much, it's not about so much about world domination as actually an insurance policy. And that a lot of them are actually just a more positive way of looking at them, the kind of way of relabeling them in a way, is to see them as gap fillers because they can't penetrate existing clumps. They're only going to grow in situations where they can grow. And of course, conventional gardening leaves so many bare spaces between plants that in a more ecological style, where plants are denser, there's simply less room for these things. But they play an important role, and that spontaneity, that moving around, is something that I think should be embraced rather than make us nervous.
And also, I think taking people to the next level. So also when people are considering a plant that they read is a thug or a rogue or it will take over your life, it's actually encouraging people to manipulate plants and put plants under stress. So some plants in their ideal conditions, yes, they will seed everywhere or spread or do what they do. But if you're putting them into a slightly inhospitable, you know, very dark shade or, you know, something like that, then maybe, you know, you can enjoy the fact that they are romping away, but they're doing a really good job. So that's sort of taking people to a slightly where they get, you're saying to them, look, you know, it is normally a thug, but actually, look, you know, it can be just the right plant for you.
It's funny you both talking about thugs, as we call them. It reminds me of many, many, many years ago, a mentor friend person, the person who started the Gardens at Wave Hill in New York City, called Marcos Dufano. You know, I would say, Marco, oh, this is the thug. And he would say, Margaret, who has the shovel? You or the plant?
That's a good one. Yeah.
You know? And so, you know, we can also edit again, that editing thing a little bit. Clearly there are some plants that are, and you have them there and we have our own species here, horrible invasives that should not, are beyond thugs, that should not be allowed in
exactly
habitat. And we're not talking about that. We're talking about, you know, there may be a monarda that you really want that for the hummingbirds, but it's a little bit thuggish in the mixed planting.
Yes. Yeah. And one thing that I've noticed, we're talking about creative pruning, is I come out every year and I teach a garden design course at Chanticleer. And it's a 5-day course, and people come from all over the states to do it. So I've got a range of people from very different zones and different areas of the states. But when we start to talk about multi-stem trees, or we start to talk about pleaching, there's usually a deafening silence, because over here in the UK, it's like, oh yeah, okay, pleaching, okay, multi-stem, oh, everyone's doing it. And yet when I use those terms, people go, well, actually, no, not sure I know what that is. And then I have to show them or draw a diagram. And that's really interesting, because in England, those two, I mean, they're almost being overused, but they're still really lovely ways of manipulating, you know, woody shrubs or trees into interesting shapes, or providing screening, which of course we live on a very, very congested island, so, you know, everybody wants privacy. And I'm always slightly baffled by the fact that that hasn't quite, to my knowledge anyway, taken off on your side of the pond.
What's taken off here is 100 new cultivars of dwarfer hydrangea paniculatas, little blobs that have names like Little Bunny and I don't even remember what else. Do you know what I mean? It just, let's just shrink it and make it so it doesn't grow.
That's
and again, that's that no maintenance, low maintenance thing. And those plants are perfect for certain applications. And I don't mean to sound so disdainful, but, you know, on the other hand, they don't have that exuberance and that life, like full of life feeling of,
So. I mean, I think there's a particular problem in the United States with pruning, in that so much of the pruning that's done is so bad. Just thinking of the famous, you know, the meatball pruning.
Oh, we're guilty of that here, Noel.
Nothing like the same level. And it's actually very difficult then to have an intelligent conversation with a lot of people, because they're in a sort of state of reaction. I remember the late James Van Sweden, who was my privilege to sort of spend quite a bit of time with in his elder years. And, you know, if the subject of clipping or topiary came up, he would go into a kind of, he'd sort of visibly sort of get really, he'd kind of wriggle as if this was something you simply could not talk about, which is a shame, because the possibilities of creativity here are so great. Mm. And I think that, I mean, some of the most interesting clipping I've seen has been in Holland, very straightforward, very graphic, very much within a modernist aesthetic. And it's something that Pete Oudolph used to do quite a bit of. Mm. And unfortunately, because of the sort of way everyone has fallen in love with his perennials, he's rather dropped that part of his repertoire, which I think is a shame, because it was a very sort of, you know, Bauhausy modernist aesthetic that just was a nice contrast with grasses and perennials and natives.
And you in an email the other day, Noel, you said something about that we can think about developing a creative tension between, you said, human imposed order and natural disorder. So maybe we can just kind of go with that a minute, because that I think is one of the most visually exciting things about the garden.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's always a problem with, for more naturalistic planting, particularly where you're using natives, that getting public acceptance is, you know, can be an issue. And one way of showing intention with meadow or prairie type planting is to contrast it with something that is very obviously maintained. And the supreme example that I'm sure so many of us will know, even if only from pictures, is of Great Dixter in England, the late Christopher Lloyd's garden, where you had that wonderful wildflower meadow with the topiary peacocks or whatever they were.
Well, the topiary lawn, yeah.
Topiary lawn. So clearly making that statement about creative tension. And I think that there's so much more scope for doing that. I think that brings out, you know, two very different skills, one of which is the ecological gardener editing and managing over a long period of time their prairie or whatever, and then the modern topiarist. And I'm very glad to say, was Annie actually found a very sort of go-ahead young topiarist who we did an interview with a little while ago, who's, you know, showing the way forward on this kind of thing.
Yeah.
I watched that. Yes, it was great. Yeah. Great.
And Tom Stuart Smith also is, you know, he always will put in some structure, and whether that be deciduous or evergreen, that gives the garden some height or some scale or seasonality. And it never looks tired when he does it. I mean, you can see that he repeats this technique, but there's something really enchanting about it. And there's a book, a wonderful book called The Winter Garden, Andrew Montgomery and Claire Foster. Claire Foster, thank you, Noel. And they're black and white photographs. I think most of it's black and white. And some of his gardens, Tom Stuart Smith's gardens in there, just look remarkable in winter, when you've got these wonderful ghostly shadows with maybe a column of hornbeam or a column of beech or something. So I think Tom is a great user of that technique.
What I'll do is, with the transcript of this show over on awaytogarden.com, I'll include links to all these people we've been talking about and some images and so forth as well. In the last, you know, 2-3 minutes or so, I wanted to ask about Garden Masterclass. And I want to just encourage people to sign up on your homepage. I'll give the link for that. You have a newsletter, and that will alert people of what's coming next. But will you be posting like the New Year's goings on before long?
We certainly will. Well, we're really busy at the moment trying to work on our live events for next year. So always on our diary pages, which you can find very easily, there's a rolling diary going, you know, month ahead, and that a lot of that is online. And in fact, just in the last 2 or 3 days, I've had people saying, this is all online. When are the live events? When are the in-person events happening? But we are literally at the moment sorting out the live events for next year, and they go onto the diary page. And so if people, obviously from state side, they're going to be probably more interested in the online activities, but you never know, people might want to come over and join us for some of the live events too.
Yes, yes, yes. And I was interested to hear that you teach at Chanticleer. That's great. That's a fantastic spot. Yeah.
Oh, I love it. It's my fifth year. I've just done my fifth year, obviously with that interruption of 2 to 3 years. And I'll be back in July for my sixth year. And it's just a joy to teach there. It absolutely is.
So any last thoughts about what you want to encourage us, each of you wants to encourage us about sort of rephrasing, rethinking the maintenance thing a little bit?
I think it's be daring. Don't, I mean, observe and sketch. You know, I draw and sketch and write notes. You know, I always encourage my students to, we're so smartphone orientated, where we click, 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 and things get stored away. And I think if you stand and sketch something, you get a lot more understanding of it. So my parting thought would be, get a notebook, get a sketchbook, draw some sketches, draw what you're looking at, and that will help you understand it a lot more.
Okay. And Noel, do you have a last?
Yeah, I think observe and go out and walk in nature, And you look at how plants grow in nature. And that is so important for getting a sense of, you know, how plants operate and how they interact, and think about how you can take those lessons back. And since we are talking from somewhere in upstate New York, go to Innisfree. If you haven't been to Innisfree yet, remarkable garden with some truly wonderful areas that have been had sort of benign neglect for many years. And I think that's one of the most some wonderful combinations of plants there hidden away that I think is just really, really special example of what I've been talking about.
It's in Millbrook, New York. Yes, it's nearby to where I am and to where some of the local listeners are for sure. Yes. But visiting gardens and visiting nature, those are two very, very good suggestions. Well, I'm so glad that we made time to connect like this, and I hope we'll do it again. Annie Guilfoyle and Noel Kingsbury, thank you so much. And like I said, I'll give lots of citations and links and so forth with the transcript of the show over on awaytogarden.com. So thank you, and I'll talk to you again.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Underwriting support from Color Blends, supplying top-quality spring-blooming Dutch flower bulbs to landscape professionals and ambitious home gardeners. More information on the web, colorblends.com.
And I'll talk to all the rest of you again soon, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening and maintaining meantime.
Away to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.